Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case you haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Jordan Wright, co-founder and CEO of Atomic Financial, the trusted way for people to connect their payroll accounts to an app. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. Perhaps to start, you can walk everyone through a little bit of your background and also really, a little bit around the growth and story around Atomic Financial.
Sure. I got my start as an entrepreneur, as employee 10. At a cybersecurity startup while I was in college. I had a really fun time there growing that company through acquisition and then the IPO of the company that we were acquired by. I then started my own company called Unbill. We sold that company to Q2 Holdings down in Austin, Texas. That was a fintech company that helped people change their card on file. After selling that company, Unbill, to Q2, I spent a year just kind of putzing around, helping a few people out before I started Atomic. And Atomic was started in August of 2019. We've had a great time so far. It's been unbelievable. The clients have been able to pull together. When you get to be able to set the client names we do, like Robinhood and Chime and SoFi and Earnin and Moneyline and Dave and all these groups, it's really exciting for us and Coinbase and things. But yeah, it's been an exciting ride and excited to talk to you today.
Cool. And so just as it relates to Atomic, kind of like what is the key problem that you all are trying to solve?
Yeah, so Atomic came out of a lot of our experience doing user permission access to data with Unbill, but also the need for consumers to be able to provide verified information for loans, also change over where their direct deposit is sent in. All those sorts of things Atomic has done to be able to help consumers get better access to their data. You could think of us as a very similar play to a play like MX or Plaid or Finicity, but instead of banking data, it's payroll data. And instead of just viewing it, we actually can read and write data into those platforms.
So what are kind of some of the benefits to the consumer, if you will?
Yeah, a ton of benefits to the consumer. So traditionally, a consumer that is trying to get access to credit doesn't have a way to provide verified employment information. So you can think about it as, you might be able to take a picture of a pay stub. Those have been doctored in the past. But if we provide this verified information, we could give information like how long somebody's been employed. We could share more granular information about how their deductions are set up in their payroll. We could give more granular information about whether or not they contribute to a 401k. All of these sorts of data points we see as being crucial to future lending decisions, especially loans that are made from a cash basis or cash flow basis. That's an important part of what we do. It also gives the consumers mobility. So one of the things we track internally is how many consumers we have helped move onto a financial institution that doesn't charge them fees for different pieces of the financial puzzle, right? And so this last year, we estimate we saved over $140 million for consumers by helping them switch off of banks that were charging them high fees onto financial institutions that aren't doing that.
Very cool. And then so, when you say, you move them off some of these, higher fee institutions, is that an automated service? How do you guys kind of go about selecting and finding the right opportunities to kind of reduce the fees for the consumer?
Yeah, so we're B2B2C. So you'll find our application inside of, applications like Chime or Moneyline or SoFi or Earnin or Robinhood or all those sorts of places where somebody's signing up for a checking account and they say, I want to move my direct deposit. I want to move my paycheck over to this checking account I just signed up for. They'll move it over via our service. They'll authenticate with their payroll provider. The neobank or traditional FI will give us the account routing number. we'll put that in on their behalf inside the payroll system and update it for them.
Cool. And then any other, you know, services do you provide, anything around lending or anything else?
Yeah, actually, we're rolling out an earned wage access program that we've had tremendous success with so far. And the other piece that we have is the ability to make payments directly out of paycheck. We've been live with the solution since June of last year. But, you know, especially consumers with little or no credit score, right? We want to be able to help those people be able to go to a lender and say, hey, I'll pay like a 700 credit score or 740 credit score. In fact, I'm willing to pay directly out of my paycheck so that the money never even hits my typical checking account, right? But can be routed through to them through another holding account so that that lender can get paid. It's a way for the consumer to get a reduced interest rate. It's a way for the lender to be able to get reduced risk.
So essentially it's a priority of payments, right? And I'm just kind of curious, when a consumer kind of subscribes to this, can they reverse it and if so, do they go up to kind of like what their more natural, lending rate is? You know, what kind of happens when they opt into this program?
Yeah, good question. They can reverse it. Our providers are the lender themselves is on the hook for how they have that relationship with that consumer, but they can reverse it. And I feel like that's an important part of having a successful program like this. They're obviously still on the hook for the loan, and most lenders get more than one payment method on file for the consumer so that they can follow up with them. But we also can track whether or not they're repaying on loans that they're taking out like this with us. And as we track those, we can begin to build our own sort of credit score for this consumer for a more cash flow based credit. And I think that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's really cool. And also, you know, what's really interesting to me is, you know, you've clearly got a bit of a background in kind of, you know, starting some new companies. So I'm kind of curious, you know, with your experiences, what are some of the kind of the first or top lessons that you've learned so far?
Yeah, I would say our last company, we never started scaling the way we have in this company. And so culture wasn't something that we had to put a tremendous amount of focus on because it was a pretty natural outgrowth of the founders. And when we only got to 15 people or something like that, it was a pretty close, tight-knit group. But this time it felt different from the very early stages of starting our company. And so what we did was we went about building our culture pretty systematically. Basically, our entire company was built during COVID. And so we have a ton of remote people. And that has been a challenge. I would say in most CEO get-togethers that I go to, well, one of the main topics of conversation is how do you continue to build a great culture? How do you help people feel like they're part of a broader team when everybody is remote? And so we've done some very purposeful things there to be able to help people continue to come together. We do more frequent company meetings than we did in our last company to help people come together more often. I would say some of the other things that we have done differently is our greatest achievement, my co-founder and I would say from starting Unbill, is seeing the success of all of the people that joined us, in the years since, and being able to provide them with an incredible opportunity career-wise. We all look back with fondness in those early days where we were like totally scrappy and trying to figure stuff out and couldn't pull things together sometimes, and other times we could. But I would say that is a lesson learned this time is I'm definitely enjoying the journey of this young, scrappy time, and also making sure that the people that join us, we're trying to give them opportunities to grow and become their best selves. One of the lines that we say for everybody that we're hiring is we want to give you an opportunity to the best work of your life. And we tell them, like, for some people, like that looks different for different people. So help us understand what that looks like for you, especially in the hiring process, to make sure that you want to actually be here. But for us, it looks like having an immense challenge every day and being able to provide a huge amount of impact on the world, especially for the more vulnerable people in our society financially.
So just as it relates to remote work, you know, especially building a company during the time, do you view it obviously maybe with some, you know, maximum optionality, but do you view a world in which you do have a centralized headquarters and people do at least have the option to kind of work together in the same office?
Yeah. And we have a central headquarters in Salt Lake City, Utah. One of the things, we did our first on-site with everybody at our company last November, and it was really an enjoyable experience for everybody to come together. We had a couple of people that refrained because of COVID, but almost everybody was there. We didn't push anybody, but we plan on doing those quarterly going forward. And the nice thing about not having to have massive offices is that we can have a little bit more budget for spending time together. And so we've told our teams, look, as long as it's within budget, I don't care if you go to Hawaii together, right? Like spend time together every quarter and do it in a meaningful way that's work-related, but also getting to know each other. And that was one thing that we focused on. I think we had 3 days in person for our November on-site. One of them, we just played. We just had a fun time together. And the other 2 days, we worked together and got a lot of stuff done. But I think it's important, especially when you're remote, when you don't have those times like playing ping pong at lunchtime or, you know, just going to grab lunch together on a regular basis. When you don't have those times, you have to build them into your company offsites, and you got to find ways to enable people to spend time with each other and build relationships.
So, like, you know, keeping with the theme of culture, how do you think, you know, how does the company, and then also how do you think that potential prospective employees and also kind of, you know, current employees weigh or value culture relative to other considerations in any job?
Yeah. So I'll take the second one first and hopefully I remember the first one. But I think that the way that most people that we talk to view culture, most people I think have kind of figured out by this point that culture is as important component of the job as salary. I think they both have like certain minimums that have to be met on culture and on salary, right? And so we definitely work to, we have people that interview just for culture. So, and that's, and a lot of people view it as us grilling somebody on how they are a cultural fit for us. It's actually the reverse. Every cultural interview we have, we lay out our values for somebody very quickly, and then we give them time to ask them about our values. And then we find is a much better way than just preaching at people all day long our values, letting them self-select if those are the values that they have. One of our values is giving back. And I did an interview with somebody probably 6 months ago, and the person said to me like, oh gosh, you know, our question was, in the last 6 months, tell me what you've given back to someone you know or your community and what it meant to you and why you did it. And that's the question we ask on a regular basis. This person said, gosh, I've been planning a wedding for the last 6 months, so I just haven't had any time to do that. My comment to him was, I'm really excited for you getting married, but, you know, sounds like giving back is not enough of a priority for you, even though you're planning a wedding right now, but it's just not enough priority for you. And that's important to us that we have people here that like giving back, because that's what we do as a group. We have 5 days given to our employees to be able to give back to the cause of their choice throughout a year. You know, those are really valuable things for us. It's how we stay centered and the kind of work we're doing to help the more financially vulnerable people in our society. We want people that want to help those people.
Very cool. And like, you know, just kind of thinking a little bit more about, you know, like kind of like what the future of the workplace is, right? I think like culture is something that's becoming more and more of a conversation throughout all the, you know, hiring conversations. But, you know, as you all think, you know, kind of about the growth of the company, you know, do you believe you'll be able to reach your full potential without maybe having more of a central office where you have the vast majority of your headquarters folks, you know, around innovating, collaborating kind of like what some of those kind of like, you know, creative ideas that come out from being in person for more extended periods of time? Or do you feel as though, you know, structurally in the way that you've set up things around culture and obviously your workplace that, again, you guys, and maybe it's not just around, you know, maybe it's more about all companies than just yours, but do you think like there's anything you give up long-term by being fully remote?
There's definitely some things that are lost by being fully remote. And we miss those things sometimes. However, I do think that getting together on a quarterly basis, I mean, we oftentimes will have people that we have a budget for people just anytime you want to fly out to headquarters and spend time with us, you can, right? And oftentimes people coordinate that together. Like, hey, I'm going to go out in the next 3 weeks. Anybody else want to go out with me? I'm just going to be there for 2 days for a client thing, blah, 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 right? I think that is important. And I think you can't underestimate the value of serendipity and like just being there in serendipitous moments and talking about something and it leads to something else. So yeah, we think that's important. There are ways to create that in a more virtual world. We did get Oculuses across our company to be able to help people engage remotely. Some of the new software, we tried some of the early software for Oculuses and like meeting remotely, and they were pretty bad. We now have several teams that meet exclusively over Oculus. And it's fascinating, and they can map to your keyboard and to your desk space. Now you can put your screen up inside of the virtual reality, and it allows for more of a hangout conversation that we're having right now. But even more so, you can high five each other, you get a reaction, you can do so many other things, interact with each other in so many other ways. I personally don't love that future. I much prefer the future of in person and being together and, you know, enjoying the world that we live in. But the fact of the matter is, I think that's the future we're headed toward. I think it gives greater flexibility for people, for employees. It gives greater flexibility for us to be able to hire the best talent no matter where they are. which I also think will raise people's income across the board around the United States, as opposed to being, you know, centered in New York and San Francisco have this massive comp. And I mean, we're starting to see a leveling of that compensation across the United States, which I think is great for people.
It's also, it's just constantly interesting. Like, I think, I imagine founders and CEOs at all levels of all companies have to figure out what that trade-off is between like what they think intuitively will be best for the company versus what, you know, they're very clearly hearing from their workforce, which is obviously like a more flexible future, which I imagine is always just a tough trade-off, because, you know, you have this ideal of like what the culture is that you can kind of feel and touch and experience on a more daily basis, at least in person. I would imagine that's kind of tough, knowing that, you know, again, the what the marketplace is actually kind of dictating is maybe a little bit more of a fluid environment. The other thing that's just interesting, I'm kind of curious, as you brought up like Oculus, we've had conversations with some real estate folks around like Google and Facebook, and, you know, they both have some vested interest in kind of a digital and work remote environment, as, you know, they can, you know, again, create some value props for things like Oculus or Google Meets and some of their digital technologies. But then also we see them buying up some of the largest, you know, actual real estate or office real estate in major cities like Austin, New York, and all those. And it's just kind of curious to me with whether or not, you know, it's just window dressing, you know, in terms of being this fully, you know, work from anywhere forever type model, or if eventually, you know, it's just kind of a bit of a short-term thing that they're all eventually expecting to get everyone to move back, you know, sort of into some of these central locations.
Yeah. I'm not the one to comment on it, to be totally candid. Like, I wish I knew what Google is thinking in that regard. But I can say what we are thinking is that having a place to come into is important. We actually just invested in a larger office space, because when we had everybody on site, we were just crammed like sardines in a can. I mean, like, it was just so tight. So we invested in a larger office space, but we're going to be using the office space very differently than we would have 3 years ago, right? I mean, we have a very open area for like hanging out and playing together. We're going to be subleasing a portion of our office space to local fintech companies that want to be able to come in, especially our customers, and be able to have a place where they can come meet their clients in person if they really wanted to, without having to get office space for themselves. So we're going to be using it very differently than we would have, again, 3 years ago.
Very cool. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, like, as you think about the growth of the company, you know, you think about some leadership styles like an Elon Musk, where it's kind of, you know, shoot for the moon and kind of, you know, still end up in a really good place. I'm kind of curious how you go about thinking about setting, you know, kind of company goals with your leadership team. You know, how much do you guys try to, you know, reach for the almost unattainable in hopes of, you know, great outcomes? Or is it really just kind of more rooted in trying to find goals that you think are attainable, but obviously, you know, keep a good trajectory for the company?
Yeah, we definitely set our goals on things that are more attainable as a company. And we do that for ourselves across valuation of our company. I have many times taken a smaller valuation to take money from a better investor that I liked, that I wanted to be on this long-term journey with. So that is important to us. I would also say that we want to be mission-driven, not in just, hey, we have this great mission that we can talk to people about, but we measure it with our board on a regular basis. I looked every board member in the face and said, I'm not going to prioritize profits over people. And you have to be okay with that before coming on, before investing in our company. And if there are some people that aren't going to be able to, not going to be treating our consumers the way that they should be treated, then we won't work with those people. Somebody else can go work with those people. That's fine. But we just won't empower their solutions. So I think that starts with our mission, but I think it also carries over into, I joke, yeah, I grew up in Southern Oregon in a small town. My co-founder grew up in Ohio and a couple other places around the country. And like, as we look at what's happening with valuations and stuff like that, we are way more conservative. Like, hey, you know, when a market correction happens, we don't want to be the one that extended ourselves so far that now our employees can't have a great exit because of what we've done with our valuation or otherwise. I would also say that, you know, as far as our business goes, we have always tried to set attainable goals. We hit all of our goals for 2021. I mean, if you put a bunch of founders in a room and said, what did your model say you would do in 2021, and raise your hand if you achieved it, most would be saying, yeah, our model was way more aggressive than what we actually achieved. We try to stay a little bit more realistic and try to hit those goals. And we've created incredible value by doing that.
Very cool. You know, I do want to talk a little bit about around markets and kind of, you know, especially VC markets and what kind of, you know, the changing dynamics mean for that space. But before we get there, I just want to kind of quickly touch on, you know, what the backdrop is for you and your company overall, just around hiring, right? Like, what are some of the competitive pressures you guys are seeing? And, you know, do you think that those are going to sustain themselves, or do you think that they slowly kind of abate a little bit?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm no prophet and I cannot see the future. We try, but the farther out you get, the more likely you are to be wrong. And so one of the things we've tried to do is over the last year, we've given several raises. You know, we've given at least two or three waves of raises to people internally. And we see that from the market when we're hiring, and that helps us understand where our employees need to be from a comp standpoint. At the same time, everybody has stock that is growing in value tremendously fast, which is helpful for us and helpful in the conversation with them, because we also can't have our costs skyrocket at the same time. But we believe in being fair to all of our employees and paying them market rates. And we always would prefer that we go to them, we reach out to them as opposed to them coming to us. And by creating that kind of a relationship, I think we've created great trust. We've had several employees say, I've never had an employer come to me outside of a 1 year, you know, review process about an increase in pay. And especially in the current market, I think that buys a lot of trust, and it leads them to having a conversation with us first before trying to go out and say, screw these guys. I'm just going to go get a job somewhere and show them how much I'm worth, because we have been, you know, tried in every case to make sure we're aligned with market as it's changed and shifted.
And then just kind of playing on that a little bit more around one of your earlier comments, you know, I think you mentioned your headquarters are out in Salt Lake City. I'm not sure the rest of, you know, the kind of the team is kind of, you know, dispersed throughout the country. But do you guys generally like have to, and I don't want to be sensitive here, like, you know, do you guys kind of have to think about where the location of the employee is, or is it kind of like, hey, we don't care where you work. This is kind of the range for the role based on what we think is fair.
Yeah. It's more about what's the range for the role. I've never asked where does the person live in a conversation. So it's more about the role. So yeah, we did hire somebody that lives in Europe, and that was a conversation that was a little bit around where they live, but that was the only time we've ever asked the question. It was more around tax responsibility and obligations and making sure we got that right, because we'd never hired somebody there. But yeah, I would say that was the only time it was a key consideration for us. Outside of that, this is what we want to pay for the role, and we'll find it where we'll pay that to whoever they are, wherever they are.
Very cool. And then, so kind of pivoting back to you know, kind of fundraising, VC valuations and everything, what do you think, you know, are kind of some of, I know you have your own personal philosophy for really valuing who you work with over kind of then the, you know, what they're willing to either inject in capital into the company or even the valuation at which they do. How do you kind of see that dynamic maybe more broadly playing out over 2022, just knowing that, you know, the market's already starting to maybe throw some lower terminal values on some of the companies that that exist today?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've told our employees is that, you know, we'll always optimize for the best investor for us. And we also won't ever put ourselves in a situation that we don't think we're worth the value that we're talking about from a fundraising standpoint. One of the nice things for us was we actually had an acquisition offer this last year at the same, and that kind of set a price point for us at our fundraise, because I felt like, hey, if we have an acquisition offer at this price point, then we're not going some sky high valuation that we cannot reach. And so that set a benchmark for our fundraise. And it was right around the same time. And so I think that that is important for founders to keep that in mind, because at the end of the day, if we don't create value for the people that work with us, and if all that value is just coming to us and our investors, I have failed as a founder. I want the people that do all this hard work every day to be able to capitalize on that financial outcome. And by taking these successively higher and higher valuations that are in some cases just way, way out of the norm, I think they're doing their employees a disservice because of the strike price and things like that employees will experience. But also the incentives of VCs are they want you to be $1 billion or bust, because they are aligned to get, you know, their top performing company will return their whole fund and so on and so forth, right? And so with each of their other successive companies. So they are pushing you for $1 billion plus exit. And I'm like, look, in what world is it not okay for a founder to sell a company for $800 million and do incredibly well by them and all their employees, right? I'm not saying that's what we're going to do, but that's a ridiculous world if people are like $800 million is not enough for me when they invested at a $30 or $40 million valuation initially, right? That's crazy. So we're just trying to make, we want to be a little bit more buck the trend, I guess you could say, and just say, hey, like, what are real valuations of companies like? Sometimes they stay in that range, but oftentimes they do not stay in ranges. They go up and down in cycles. And we want to make sure, regardless of the cycle, we're in a good position, at the best positioned from a valuation standpoint, but also with the revenues we're generating.
Do you think overall that kind of valuations are coming down for, you know, especially like fintech, which has been hot? I know payments obviously has been very hot. Like, do you think valuations overall are coming down to start the year? Or do you think that's just, it's just too short term right now to really see an impact?
I think it's too short term to see an impact. I mean, obviously public markets have come down significantly in some of the series you just mentioned. Private markets, we don't see coming down that much. I mean, it could be that announcements today and in the next couple of months are actually from 2 or 3 months ago. And so maybe that's something that is impacting it. But all of these VC funds have a ton of money to spend still, despite where markets at or are going. And I mean, I still get 5 inbound investor requests like a week right now. So it's not slowing down for me.
Yeah, very interesting. And then, like, you know, do you think that, I think one of the things that you were saying, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, is essentially that there's, you know, a lot of these funds have raised capital or at least raised commitments for them to invest. And a lot of them haven't really been able to deploy that yet, right? For numerous reasons, you know, vintage, as well as also just kind of the market backdrop, which has been a little bit, you know, hot. Do you think it's more likely that they continue to kind of like find ways to deploy it no matter what? Or do you think it's a scenario where they kind of, you know, don't end up actually investing all the money that they've maybe had committed to them?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, to be honest. I think they're going to try to from what we've seen, they're just trying to commit this capital in any way they can find, most of them. I think some of them are being more responsible in that regard, but a lot of people are just trying to find ways to deploy this capital. But at the same time, I don't think you can deploy as much capital as out there in startups right now. I mean, we have companies raising massive rounds at big valuations, but whether or not those valuations can see an outcome, you know, how many companies are really acquired at more north of a couple billion dollars, right? How many companies can actually acquire those companies, right? It's a pretty short list of companies that can acquire another company for over $1 billion. And so being able, unless the plan is to IPO and all that kind of stuff, that's great, right? But outside of that, I don't see it as possible that a lot of these companies end up having this awesome acquisition exit. Maybe they SPAC or maybe they do something like that. But, you know, we've seen some of those be very successful last year. Not most of them, though. I mean, they've been fine. And some of them have tried and hasn't worked out. So it'll be fascinating. And we'll all have a seat at the table watching it go down. But it'll be very interesting to watch.
Just around conversations and kind of what you know about the market overall. And again, I don't want to speak too much about Atomic because that's more sensitive. But, you know, what are some of the key kind of valuation metrics that you're seeing VCs focus on? You know, obviously, you know, profitable companies are less likely based on where they invest in the market. Then also, you know, just to kind of play that a little bit further, you know, what are kind of some of the growth metrics that you think really become attractive for a VC that show that like this company is really sustainable and is likely going to be, you know, one of the few that break through?
Yeah, I would say customer retention is one of the most important aspects in fundraising. It shows that you have market fit when you have acquired a large number of customers and are retaining them. And as example, in our market, we have over 65 customers that work with us. We've never lost a single customer. And we've pulled multiple customers, I think half a dozen in the last year, off of each of our competitors. And to me, that's a very strong sign of our market and how we're performing in it. I think that is an important aspect. I think founders is still important at our stage, which we would be like a Series B stage company, right? The founders are important to investors at that stage. They're going to play a critical role in the future of the company. And founders that are a little too crazy, founders that have a tainted background, like things like that, that's going to make it difficult for those companies to work with VC firms. And we've seen that in a couple of instances. I'll say the other one is, you know, revenue growth and TAM. I think those two things, when you have fast revenue growth, fast customer growth, and you're chasing a massive TAM, those all are...
TAM just being target addressable market, you know, essentially what is the total size of the opportunity?
Yeah, total size of the opportunity, right? So in our space right now, payroll APIs, I think there will be multiple billion-dollar companies in our space. I think there can be companies that IPO in our space. I think there will be companies that can get acquired at that price point in our space. Like, I think that's a total likelihood in the future, is that we see a couple of or a few billion-dollar companies, as we've seen with the aggregation space with MX and Infinity and Plaid and other companies, right? So there are several billion-dollar companies in that space. I think we'll see something similar in our space, but to me, customer retention is the most important metric. If you cannot keep your customers, even if you're growing fast, if you're growing fast and you're signing a lot of customers and you're losing a lot of customers, that is not a good sign, because either you're not treating them well, or you're selling out ahead of your skis. You're telling people you have things that you don't, and customers are becoming dissatisfied not with the vision, but with the execution.
Very cool. Joy, I want to turn over to you for any closing thoughts. Anything else that you wish we touched on that we didn't, and maybe also you can let everyone know how to find or learn more about Atomic Financial.
Cool. So I would say one of the things that we see today is, and I'll just share something, maybe a personal note. I tell all my investors, I don't care about being a billionaire someday. And some people, that turns them off, and other people don't mind it. But I really don't care about having like that kind of money someday. I care about building a product that has high impact on the world. And a lot of people don't feel that way. But we need, and it's like, my hope is that we can get more mission-driven companies that want to have impact. And I get that the financial side is an allure for founders. And I'm not saying like I'm a charity case. Like I'm not trying to say that I don't care about the money or some money, right? But I really feel like there's more room in the world for companies that want to do good and make money at the same time. And also for founders to be a little bit more open with their employees from a stock standpoint, and making sure that their employees can participate in the upside of a company. We're actually going through a situation right now where we're going to refresh stock for a bunch of employees at our company, because we feel like they've been incredible to us, and we want to make sure that they know that we're grateful. And very few have asked for that. Maybe two have asked for that, or three, but we're going to do it across a large group of people in our company. And so I think that's an important thing for people to know, is that if you succeed as a founder and the people that you brought along the journey don't, then I think that says a lot about you as a human. And I'd much rather be known as a good human than as a billionaire.
Just such an interesting comment. Also, because I just think about you think about people that attain, an incredible amount of wealth, the tens of billions of dollars. You think about what motivates them. And it's very interesting to think about how much of that is just driven by the competition of being the top or near the top, and kind of that own competition within that different sphere, as opposed to kind of just being grounded in how much has already kind of been attained. So it's always an interesting fate for what motivates people.
The phrase I always tell my children is, comparison is the thief of joy. And I feel that way personally. And I found in my career, the times where I was comparing myself to others, it limited my own happiness. And when I was 30, I decided I'm never going to compare myself to anybody else. And I'm going to root out those feelings, even though they're natural to all of us, and just be happy with the life I have and try to be the best I can be and measure against myself. And do I still slip into comparison sometimes? Yeah, absolutely. Right. But I try to root it out of myself when I do, and realize that it takes away your joy and it takes away the genuine happiness in the moment for you when you do.
Great advice. Couldn't agree more. Jordan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, of course, to all of our listeners. Remember to visit YieldStreet.com to learn more about our offerings and come to realize your next level with us. Subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. And thank you, and see you again next week.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to YieldStreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at YieldStreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.